Welcome to this episode of the Security Clearance Careers Podcast, Clearcast, your source for security clearance, intelligence community, espionage, national security, and defense contracting updates. In our exclusive interviews with intelligence community and government leaders.
Hello, hello, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Security Clearance Careers Podcast. I am your host, Katie, and today my guest, Bartholomew Perez, got his start in mechanical engineering after leaving home for university, later earned his master's in architecture-based enterprise systems engineering, and then got a professional certificate in electronic warfare technology. So you worked for one of the top defense contractors in this space and are now a program lead, amongst other things. And so today we're really going to home in on your journey because it really is a great one for those who are looking to get their start in the cleared space, but maybe didn't serve in the military, which is a huge kind of myth that I'm always having to bust. But before we get started with our conversation, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Katie. And what a phenomenal introduction. I'm happy to be here and talk on this subject today.
Yeah, yeah. And before we get started, I do want to highlight just you made this incredible YouTube video kind of calling out our secret squirrel calendar and some of the content that we're pushing out on social media. And so that's actually how we got connected. So people being online is really important, especially from a job seeker's perspective. Like you really need to, you know, have the gusto and the confidence to kind of get your sort of job seeker brand out there. Not necessarily that you're job seeking, but at least that's how we connected. So I did want to highlight that here, but let's kind of dive in. Tell me a little bit about how you got your start in the cleared space.
Absolutely. So my start was in engineering. I did not have a military background, so that is really where it started. I did my undergrad in mechanical engineering from Cal State Northridge in California. And after graduation, as a recent grad, I needed a job. And I had two interests. One was in biomed, the other was in defense and aerospace. So between the two, I interviewed extensively at several places. And when it came down to it, I had a strong interest in defense and aerospace. So I started off with Mason Controls in Solmar, California, and they specialize in control systems. So anything that a pilot would interface with in a cockpit, that's essentially what they helped manufacture and deliver to their customers. So the idea of service through being an employee through a defense contractor was my idea of how I could serve back. Although I didn't serve in the military, I did feel a need that because I've been in this country for a long time that I have a sense of gratitude. And so this was my way of doing it. After I did a year and a half at Mason Electric, then I transitioned into Northrop Grumman. And my way into Northrop Grumman was, I did two things. I did the shotgun method, extensive online applications, and I counted them up to 71. And then I went through my network, which going through my network first would have been optimal route where the students that I had graduated with, class of 2015, would have been the ideal pool to seek referrals for role in Northrop Grumman. And after a phone interview with the recruiter, everything else was done. And it was really a matter of, okay, when can I start after the phone call? The particular job was requiring of a security clearance. And after that, I faced a bit of a concern just because of the clearance process itself. But this first initial role in Palmdale, California, as a packaging engineer in a global supply chain organization was really where my start in a cleared environment really began.
Thanks so much for sharing that. You touched on a couple of things. It's really important as you are trying to break into a new job, a new role, a new industry, really tapping into your network and seeing who can make that connection for you because it is all about networking and it is all about who you know. And so I want to talk about timelines because knowing when you graduated, knowing that you didn't serve in the military to obtain a security clearance, that's kind of the biggest question I get from folks who don't work in this space currently but really want to is, how do I convince somebody to sponsor me? And I know that the security clearance processing timelines has gone through quite the journey, even in the amount of time that I've been working in defense contracting. We had, you know, the height of the backlog in 2017, which is actually around the same timing of when you obtained that security clearance initially. So tell us, how did you convince someone to sponsor you? Did it take a ton of convincing? What sort of tactics can listeners here implement when it comes to positioning themselves for a clearance job?
Such a phenomenal question. And when people come into the space, they don't really realize what that meant with the backlog of 2017, where there was upwards of 700,000 pending security clearance investigations. And depending on what type of clearance you were getting, whether it's secret, top secret, then really that determined how long it was going to take, where there were instances that for top secret clearance, you would wait upwards of 450 days. So that's almost a year and a quarter. In my particular case, because the job itself required clearance going in, I knew that this was something I was going to be submitted for. I was also told, hey, there's an extensive wait period just because of the climate, and contractors don't have priority because first comes government officials and those that are related and involved directly with government, and then come the contract employees. So when it comes down to it, yes, it costs money to be able to sponsor somebody, and it costs money for the contracting agency or enterprise to hold that security clearance. So because of that, I have to meet an investigation and a set of requirements in order to even be able to have a security clearance. So when it came down to it, it was really about understanding, hey, this role requires a clearance, one, and then two, are you fit to do the job that we're requiring of you? So at the time, as a packaging engineer, a lot of involvement with computer-aided design, understanding of manufacturing, rapid prototyping, and also at least a bit of understanding of contracts. All said and done, my wait period for interim clearance, which means you're almost there but not yet, that was about 6 months. And then to actually fulfill was about a year, year and a half. So in total, during that wait period, we called it the icebox. And that's basically where you would go to wait. And while you can't do what you were hired for on the secret side, you have unclassified work that you might be able to do in support, which at least in Palmdale, California, that was an extensive amount of work because of the nature of the work that was happening there. So between convincing someone that you could do the job, convincing someone that your background will not at least have any hiccups for you to be able to obtain the clearance, because you can definitely be denied. But at least in my case, that was not the case. And so I was able to obtain the secret clearance at that time. So 2018-ish, that's when I was awarded my clearance.
Well, and that's great, because I feel like, again, candidates that are like, you know, I really need to get one, a clearance initially, or a lot of service members who have let their clearance lapse, they are trying to get it back. You know, they're going for that TSSCI. And it's like, hold on a second. It's probably more beneficial in terms of convincing an employer to sponsor you to go for that secret level, because the investigation isn't going to take as long. And I mean, you held out for that interim clearance. And in the meantime, of that 6 months of you getting that interim secret clearance, were you working elsewhere in the private sector or commercial industry while you waited to kind of get your in defense?
Yeah, at that time, I was already at Northrop, and I was doing other assignments that were unclassified much later, exactly how you described it, because it was a stepping stone. If we submitted you outright for top secret, chances are we're not going to get you there to be able to help us out with the work, because there's a huge backlog. And so at the same time, while all of us that were submitted at the time were waiting, we had a duty to fulfill for what our backlog looked like for at least this global supply chain packaging engineering role at Northrop Grumman. So between 2017 through 2018, that's really the period I was waiting, but there was enough work that was unclassified at Northrop to be able to be done.
Even if it says, you know, security clearance required, with some of these larger companies, it is, if you meet every other requirement, could be worth it to apply in the hopes that they will sponsor you while you can do that unclass work. So let's talk a little bit more about the security clearance process, because that can be one of the most daunting things for someone who's trying to break into this industry. Like, yeah, I remember when I was first getting in defense contracting, it was really the unfamiliar with it. Like, oh my gosh, our investigator is going to like freak out about some of the family members that I have that may not, you know, maybe denied a security clearance out from the get. So you've shared with me that you are a child to immigrant parents. And so tell us about some of your worries when it came to applying for a job requiring a security clearance and some of the adjudicative criteria. And tell us your thoughts as you were kind of entering that process.
Yeah, absolutely. After I was told about this SF-86, I realized that this was a large questionnaire about basically who you are as a person, what you're involved with, a holistic picture of who I was. Things it was asking for was identifying contact information, my citizenship, residential history, education, employment, military history, if any, and then came relatives and foreign contacts. And because I had immediate family members that were foreign, because the way that the questionnaire reads is anybody that might not be a U.S. citizen, my parents didn't fall into that category. So one, I had to disclose naturally, and I did. And that raised concerns because I wasn't sure what was going to happen to them. And then at the same time, I wasn't sure what that would mean for my security clearance. Granted, I knew that I had friends that might have been in a similar situation. And when I asked, I wouldn't get a response. And then going into Reddit threads and all these forums about what that means, and a lot of them were very negative, where, yeah, you can outright be denied a security clearance because of a foreign contact. What they didn't necessarily say is what sort of influence they have, the frequency of that contact, and what sort of ties, whether they're financial or maybe some support that you might provide for these relatives, because that's also part of the picture. Is what the government really wants to know is, are you going to be coerced into divulging? Are you going to any way, shape, or form be subject to blackmail and that sort of thing, because you're basically entrusted with government secrets, and depending on the level of your clearance, that is very sensitive information, which can lead to a number of impacts in various ways. So they want to look at these sort of things, and it's a strong consideration. And so after disclosing that, I remember I had a hard time wrapping my mind around it, and I let time do its thing. I trusted that by my disclosing that, at least I was honest, I was open about the whole situation, and it was just up to the investigators. And there were interviews that I knew were happening too. And part of that, I'm sure, was to gather the bigger picture of who I was and what sort of influence and contacts I might have. My biggest concern really was on the foreign contact side and relatives. Granted, I was awarded my clearance. It might have been a concern, but it didn't prevent me from obtaining my clearance. Anytime there's a foreign contact that comes up, because we have an obligation to disclose it. It's a practice where you have to share what's going on, because they will find out. And I think the worst thing anybody can do in this sort of environment is withhold information or just outright lie about it.
I totally agree. And I mean, it sounds like it was a positive thing that you're just like, all right, I'm coming clean. You know, we'll see where the cards fall. When you were going through, you know, your subject interview, and then obviously you had to list references, you know, having that sort of fear with some of your family members, were they interviewed by investigators? Like, tell us about that process, and maybe even how you had to kind of converse with them about what was happening.
Yeah, so they do ask for references, and the way that it's listed is anybody that might know you very well. So that could be a best friend. If you have a significant other, they suggest those people. I had siblings, so I put down my siblings. The extent of those conversations, I don't know, but I'm sure that they were along the lines of confirming the information that I was sharing. Because my siblings were also living with my parents, that also raised a set of concerns for what that might have meant, because, again, my parents were not U.S. citizens, so I wasn't sure where that was going to go. But again, sharing those references, because they will have to interview. So I know they happened. I let them, my references, know that they were going to be approached by an investigator asking them about me, that tell them what you know, tell them don't lie, don't think you're doing me a favor by concealing the truth. And all else after that, I mean, that's really the holistic picture that they, the investigators, can have, because that's part of their job. They're asking the questions. And again, based on the SF-86, it goes back to backgrounds, where you live, how you met the person, what some of my maybe psychological habits, emotional health might be, activity, drug activity, alcohol activity, probably finances. Again, all things that are part and listed in the SF-86. But yeah, I think just anybody going through the process, let your people know that they will be approached, because it's kind of like when somebody submits you for a reference for a job, it's very much the same way. I think giving a heads up, hey, you're going to be approached by this person, don't be alarmed, it's legitimate. It's not a spy trying to reach you for something else, it's legit.
Right. I mean, that's just a normal courtesy, I would say. And, you know, I really appreciate you kind of sharing your story, because I feel like sharing that, it just kind of showcases what investigators or adjudicators actually care about. And you've kind of noted it through this conversation, like they care about you lying, they care about you being honest. And if you lie throughout this part of the process, like what's going to happen if you do have access to classified information? And so let's talk about career longevity. And, you know, throughout your career so far, you have kind of through academia and certifications and gaining new job titles and skill sets. Do you think that's kind of the secret sauce to longevity in national security or in this space or really any career?
Absolutely. I think if you have the mindset of a student, you're willing to learn and fail and deliver solutions, then I think you're already set and destined for success. When it comes down to it, employers want to know, do you know about the product? Are you aware of our industry and what's going on real time? Do you know the tools and software? And are you willing and able to take on assignments that nobody else might really want? I remember our keynote speaker back in 2015 was a executive at Northrop. And one of the things she emphasized that the assignments that you take on can really demonstrate what sort of character that you're bringing and value that you're bringing to a company, because the assignments can determine what sort of future assignments and the visibility that you'll receive within the organization and externally, because at the end of the day, we also deliver to customers, and these customers may be high profile. And I think between mentorship and sponsorship, the sponsorship are the people that will speak on your behalf, whether you know it or not. And these can be life-changing. These can be very critical to the trajectory of how you're developing your career, because oftentimes these are decision makers, and because they're decision makers, and if they think highly of you, very likely they're going to drop your name if they know you have an interest in a certain discipline. In my example, that was very true. I was started off as a packaging engineer. I remember one of my greatest mentors, and I know he was a sponsor of mine, Ralph. And Ralph, going in, he was retiring soon. I knew that his practice as a packaging engineer and in the discipline of packaging handling, storage, and transportability was a dying art. And I took care in being able to consume as much wisdom as he had to share, because I found it that oftentimes these sort of dying arts on how we deliver products that can make a difference for our customer. And it just so happened that that took me into logistics engineering. I was not in a logistics background, but I knew enough about packaging engineering to take me into that discipline. And my focus there was on flight critical hardware that was directly deployed to the customer and installed at the depot in Palmdale and taken elsewhere. And the big visibility project here was this particular flight critical object that they had to repackage the materials in a much more ruggedized container that required special packaging instructions. That was basically a lost art, and the discipline of logistics itself was one of the very last things most enterprises think about. After that, I went into architecture-based enterprise systems engineering at UC San Diego. And I knew because of what was happening in the industry around the 2017 through 2020 time between digital engineering and being able to be more agile in the industry to deliver much faster so that the customer can determine instead of going decades on a program that is expected to be produced, that there's quicker decision making for the customer. Between that and the transition into Melbourne, Florida, to continue that discipline as a modeling and systems engineer, systems architecture, and now in Orlando, Florida, same thing, because at this point, I treat it as my craft. I treat it as an art, and I treat it in a manner that how else can I deliver more value having a breadth of knowledge, because I do like the idea of being jack of many trades, master of many, and being able to work cross-functionally to arrive at a solution, because when it comes down to it, customers want answers. And if you don't have an answer, do you have at least a set of options that you can present, have it so that they can work with you to arrive at a solution? And as long as there's this whole theme of being able and willing to learn, failing along the way and including your customer, then I think you're destined for success. And that's part of the secret sauce.
Thank you for sharing. And Jack of all trades, but also, I mean, it sounds like your curiosity is what has kept you moving in this industry and gaining all those new skill sets. And I clearly didn't do enough research on my guests, because just before we hopped on the horn here, I saw that you wrote a book. So I'd love if you would tease to that a little bit and then tell us what's next for you.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a first-time author in my family. The title is I'm Up to Something, STEM Made Me. And I say STEM made me because I do owe a lot to the discipline of engineering. I had a natural interest and gift for science and math. When it came down to it, I was one of those students that did not have to study growing up, and I just excelled in my academics. It was because of that gift that led me into the field of engineering. Also naturally, because the way I grew up, being low socioeconomic status and having that struggle of the imposter syndrome, not knowing really what route I can take, because I didn't really have strong role models growing up. But I knew that at least the value of education in my household was there. So having taken all that, culminating into, okay, I'm pretty sure that there's others just like me that have lived similar stories. And because of that, you know, sharing, how you were saying, sharing is the greatest thing we can do, because it's the oldest form of entertainment too, which is storytelling. As far as what's next, I will continue to work on my craft of systems architecture and what we call modeling based systems engineering. I find it fun. There's never a dull moment and it hardly feels like work. So I'm amazed that I get paid to do this sort of thing, because it really does not feel like work. I get lost in time, and it only comes with the level of how disciplined will you be in your craft? How much of yourself are you willing to give, not only to your customers, but to your teammates? I look forward to still being as involved as possible. And then what comes next? I look forward to that, because I know that I'll be involved in model-based systems engineering, whether that takes me elsewhere. I look forward to that sort of adventure.
That's so excellent. And I always love it when people find a job or a career or a niche or a field where it doesn't feel like work. I mean, I'm certainly in that here at Clearance Jobs, and it feels good. You're spending this much time working throughout the week in the US at least. So you want to be enjoying it. And so you say engineering was a great decision to begin a career, and you don't look back on it because as a child to immigrant parents of low socioeconomic status, playing it safe was important to you. But I mean, it sounds like you've just found your secret sauce in this industry, and that just warms my heart. So thank you so much, Bartholomew, for joining me for this episode of the Security Clearance Careers Podcast. Listeners, for more on STEM careers and how you can obtain a security clearance, you can visit news.clearancejobs.com. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of ClearCast. Hit the subscribe button and share this episode with your friends and colleagues. For more security clearance updates and national security career advice, subscribe to news.clearancejobs.com. If you have an active clearance, refresh your profile and search Clear Careers at clearancejobs.com.